Today's commandment is from Exodus 20, verse 14. It simply says, "You shall not commit adultery." In 1631, there was a reprint of the King James Version of the Bible, and it caused a nationwide scandal in England. This Bible was called the Wicked Bible because it had a misprint in the seventh commandment. It read, "Thou shalt commit adultery." Well, King Charles I was madder than a hornet, and the Pope had a cow. The printers were fined and drummed out of business. As many of the copies of this Bible that they could find were destroyed. Although, obviously, since you can get one on Amazon, a few slipped through the cracks. Looking at all the statistics on adultery, we might actually think the Bible really does say, "Thou shalt commit adultery." Because a staggering 70% of marriages in this country are affected by infidelity. The high numbers of adultery can partly be blamed on the bombardment of sexual images in our culture and the lowered sexual standards that were birthed in the 1960s. In the last generation, we have experienced a sexual tectonic shift culturally and socially. All you have to do is watch old TV shows and compare them with the recent ones to see how true this is. Us old people remember the Dick Van Dyke Show, where Laura and Rob Petrie were married. Well, if you watch the show, you can't help but notice that they have twin beds in their bedroom, and you never, ever saw them in the same bed together. Today, not only are couples in bed together, they are doing things that used to only be featured in rated R or X movies. The availability of pornography has completely changed our cultural landscape. It is the biggest internet business of our time. Like it or not, pornography is a permanent fixture in our world. The impact of easy access to pornography has been catastrophic for our kids. Our culture sees the world as a sex buffet table. There are many choices on that table, but none of them, except for the one adhering to marital faithfulness, honors the seventh commandment. This commandment, as it is literally read, condemns sexual relations between a married person and someone they're not married to. And I've heard people over the years say, "Well, I'm not married, so I don't have to pay attention to this commandment. I can't violate this commandment." Well, Jesus basically said, In Matthew 5, 27 and 28, he said, "You have heard that it was said, 'You shall not commit adultery.' But I tell you that anyone who looks at a woman lustfully has already committed adultery with her in his heart." Jesus right here is making it clear that the seventh commandment includes any inappropriate relationship in or out of a marriage. Besides, this might seem rudimentary to you, but what makes people married? Well, some people will say love makes people married. And some say, well, when the minister says, "I now pronounce you man and wife," that's what makes you married. And others will say, well, it's a signed legal certificate. Then you're married. I don't think it's the love or the ceremony or the license that make people married. I think it's what happens on the wedding night that makes people married. It's the one flesh thing that occurred between Adam and Eve. This, in my opinion, is what made them married and anybody else. You probably think at this point that I'm crazy for saying sex makes people married. But let me show you this little thing out of the Old Testament. Here's the entire account of a wedding between a man named Isaac and a woman named Rebekah. Genesis 24, 67. Isaac brought her into the tent of his mother Sarah, and he married Rebekah. So she became his wife, and he loved her. Period. The same thing happened with Jacob and his two wives, as found in Genesis 28. There was no church ceremony, no minister, no license, but they were married. How? In the sight of God, it was the sexual act that made them married. It was the official one flesh thing. So, am I or am I not saying that people are married to everybody they have sex with? No, yes, kind of. What I do do know for sure is, biblically, sex is a marrying act. And when we start to view sex as a marrying act, it causes us to think of it in a higher way. Because God views marital relations as holy and sacred. God has given us 362 admonitions as to our sexual behavior. God has not left us to guess how to behave in this arena. As found in Scripture, the Christian theology of sex includes a threefold purpose. Sex is to be unitive, procreative, and sacramental. It was created for marriage. Within a biblical context, it is impossible to defend sex outside of marriage. In my father's world, a man was considered honorable by remaining faithful to his wife. In my father's world, a man could avoid sexual temptation very simply, and I'll tell you how my dad did it. He didn't watch television. He never went to the movies. He never went roller skating. He never went to dances. He never went to bars. And he did not kiss my mother until the minister told him he could at their wedding. But this isn't my father's world anymore. Sex is in front of our faces constantly. I believe we're going to have to be much more intentional and much more smart when it comes to protecting ourselves. Now, the church usually keeps quiet about sex, and I really understand why, because human sexuality is not easy to deal with fairly or honestly. And to be honest, it makes us all squirm a little, especially when we talk about it in church. After having spent 20 years working with youth and young adults, I believe the church has done more harm than good by not addressing it. The early church embraced the Gnostic idea that the body and everything it did was evil. The church's teaching inferred that sex was bad. It was embarrassing even. There is still an undercurrent of this, even in the church today. And I don't know if you remember what the old grand pianos used to look like. They were on four huge legs. And in the early church, they thought that the legs even would be too tempting for the congregation to see. So they would put like a skirt around the legs, just so people couldn't see the legs of the piano. We've come a long way since then. The Jews have a much more healthy view of sexuality than really probably anybody else. Judaism teaches that sex is good. Judaism teaches that the marital relationship serves as a spiritual force that heals us and bonds us, comforts us, gives us shelter in a topsy-turvy world. It also teaches that sex on the Sabbath is more sacred than it is on any other day. I think that's a kick. So much of what is said about sex in Christendom is false. For instance, extramarital sex doesn't always make you feel guilty like your 90-year-old Sunday school teacher told you it would. By insisting that extramarital sex will make a person feel bad, the church is misstating the nature of sin. The truth is, we do not always feel bad after we do something wrong. The truth is, sin often feels good, which is why we do it in the first place. What I think the church needs to be saying is, extramarital sex is bad for us, no matter how it makes us feel. I also think the church needs to say that sex is not recreational. Sex matters, even though people have been brainwashed into believing that it doesn't. Sex is dangerous and delightful, and it's powerful as a hurricane, and it matters. What we do sexually shapes our inner selves. I also think the church should say that casual sex is a contradiction in terms. Sex is never casual. The Apostle Paul said, in effect, "Don't you know that when you sleep with someone, your body makes a promise whether you do or not?" The church's negligence in dealing with these matters has inadvertently allowed sexual sin to grow and take root among its members. The level of immorality going on in some churches is mind-blowing, and I'm not just talking about the members, I'm talking about the clergy. Jim and I have spent the last 2 years watching Wesleyan ministers being removed for what is euphemistically called a moral failure, like we're watching a ping pong game. It's going on all the time. Because the church is clammed up, people aren't entirely sure what a moral failing even is. I've sat through discussions with teenagers and young adults about how confused they are because no one has the courage to talk to them about it. So when I was a youth pastor and a young adult pastor, I talked about it, and I talked about it, and I talked about it. In fact, I made February into sex month because February has Valentine's Day in it, so I wanted to ruin as many people's Valentine's Day as I possibly could. You know, this might come as a surprise to you, or maybe it won't. We had perfect attendance during sex month in Sunday school. And what did surprise me is I had total support from the parents, because the parents didn't really want to talk to their kids about sex, so they let me do it. And so I did. What I know from working with kids is parents and grandparents don't feel comfortable talking to their kids about sex. Therefore, kids grow up not really sure what to or what not to do. Parents and grandparents believe that their kids are just going to naturally know. Well, newsflash, they don't naturally know. Jim and I very bluntly expressed our expectation to our boys about the way they behave themselves. Our word for good behavior, sexual or otherwise, was gentlemanly. We were so blunt with these kids that one time we were sitting in my room and one of Jim's nephews had done something pretty bad, and it was of the sexual nature. And they came up to our bedroom and we launched into, like, you know, a 45-minute lecture series on why what Jim's nephew had done was wrong and how hurtful it was and why it was hurtful and blah, 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 blah. And I remember Zach, he was probably 13 or 14, just looked at us and said, "Mom, all we wanted was a bowl of ice cream." Well, there you go. What the church needs to tell people is remaining chaste is mostly a mental game. The Apostle Paul said, "Take captive every thought to make it obedient to Christ." A large contingent of our adults in our country have been poor examples to our kids, expecting them to do as we say and not as we do. I hate to be the one to break it to you, but they are doing what we do. It might break your heart to know how many preteen kids are engaged in sexual activity. And a scary number of teenage girls say that the boys that they date expect sex as a rule of dating. The church kind of haphazardly tried to address the issue of teenage sex with the True Love Waits campaign. This campaign promoted sexual abstinence until marriage. So the kids would take a vow of celibacy in front of their church and in front of their parents, and they would get a little ring. True Love Waits, in a word, has been a flop. Follow-up studies show that kids who took this pledge were only likely to be abstinent 18 months longer than those who did not take the pledge. So they were just managing to delay sex for 18 months. And in my opinion, this is because after they made the pledge, there was no follow-up support. It seems to me that parents and grandparents must offer support to their kids in this area. One of the ways that we can do this is by monitoring what comes into our homes via the internet and television. I'm telling you, it is a landmine for your kids. This is not a guarantee, but I do think it helps. The other thing that I think we must consider if we're going to ask our kids to remain abstinent until marriage is to let them marry at younger ages than we normally would have considered. I used to think that kids should probably wait, you know, until they were near 30 to get married, especially boys. But I had this conversation with Jenny many, many years ago, and she's the one that said this to me, that we need to let them get married younger because sex is such a temptation for them. And the more I thought about it, the more I thought, she is right. But I think we have to add this too. We have to support kids that get married younger because of the unique challenges that come with younger marriages. The Apostle Paul said this in 1 Corinthians 6:20. "You were bought with a price, so glorify God in your body." The impact of the adult community not glorifying God in their bodies has had a destructive trickle-down effect on our young. Because we haven't kept ourselves pure, we haven't been able to protect them from impurity. The effects of not nationally keeping this commandment has had a very negative effect on all of us, but especially our children. Most boys have already been exposed to porn by the time they're only 11, and nearly 50% of these boys begin sexting soon thereafter. And most of their obscene texts go to girls who do not want them, leading to yet another problem, namely sexual harassment. Psychologists say the more teens are exposed to sexual content, the earlier they start having sex, and the more likely they are to have unprotected sex. And then comes with it everything else that comes from that. Early exposure to pornography and other explicit materials increases the risk of a child becoming a victim of molestation or of them becoming a molester themselves. Because the seventh commandment is not being kept, pedophilia has become an encroaching danger to our children. Because the seventh commandment is not being kept, children have become confused about who they are as sexual beings. More than 300,000 children between the ages of 13 and 17 in the United States now identify as transgendered. Because the seventh commandment is not being kept, schools all over our nation have obscene books in their libraries for children to check out. I have seen and read some of these excerpts of these books, and take my word for it, it's child abuse to let the children read these books. Because this commandment is not being kept, human trafficking has become a global business, generating billions of dollars. Recent estimates say that over 300,000 unaccompanied minors who come over our borders are missing, and many of them are feared to have fallen into the hands of sex traffickers. It would shock you to know how big and wide-ranging the market is for children as sex slaves. In fact, just this week, Jim told me that the former CEO of Abercrombie & Fitch was arrested or indicted for sex trafficking minors just this week. You see, my point is very dark things happen when this commandment is broken. It gets bigger and bigger and bigger and bigger. In my opinion, this all kind of got kickstarted in the 1960s during a time that's called the Sexual Revolution. This was a time in America when we as a whole rejected the seventh commandment. We started listening to guys named William Reich and Herbert Marcuse. They told us that the moral foundations of society were oppressive. They told us people who thought we ought to adhere to biblical values were fun suckers. They told us modern man was just a boiling cauldron of sexual repression. And because of this repression, biblical marriage was only useful in primitive societies. In those societies, you know, where women and children were oppressed and they needed man. Well, now we're so evolved in our society, we don't really need a man, so we don't really need marriage. Even worse, these guys told us that marriage was causing us to be neurotic. The cure for marital neurosis was to act out sexually, they said, and the more perverted, the better. It was a waste of time, they said, to let biblical principles help us with our neuroses. What you want to do, they said, was do what you want to do with who you want to do it and as many times as you want. In fact, the more the merrier. They told us people who were promiscuous were healthier than those who remained chaste in a marriage. They told us that traditional marriage bred fascists. If a man was tied down by marriage, they said, he could get aggressive. He would seek out authoritarian leaders and would ultimately start wars. They told us if people were free to behave any way they wanted to, they would enjoy working. Well, that's funny to me, because people do act any way they want, and they don't seem to enjoy working. The sexual revolution was a societal rejection of this commandment against adultery and every other biblical regulation on human sexual behavior. Not only are we paying the price for this decades-old rejection, but our children are as well, and I believe they are paying a higher price than we are. I am keenly aware that a lot of what I said this morning is new to some people who might be hearing me. There are those who've never probably been taught the seriousness of keeping this commandment because the church hasn't been very instructive on it, and because it's not really politically correct to talk about it. In my opinion, there's no need for castigation or beating ourselves up if we have slipped up in this area. My earnest hope and prayer is that when we know better, we'll do better. No matter what has been done, either personally or nationally, forgiveness is available. And I suppose that's one of the good things about guilt. When we feel guilt, we know we need forgiveness. And we know from Scripture that sins can be forgiven. Our souls can find relief. Those who have a sexual sin or two on their account can have them forgiven. I believe this morning Jesus is waiting to forgive, and all you have to do is ask.